True crime today.
This is the ongoing story of a small Idaho town and its residents, a tightly knit community that hasn't seen a murder since 2015, an environment where one thought they could feel safe and secure until a quadruple homicide stole the lives of four young souls on a mid-November evening, leaving far more questions than answers. Where will the investigation lead, and how do we get there? This is the University of Idaho Murders podcast. Four killed for what?
Welcome to today's edition of the program. It is December 8th of 2022 as of our recording time. I like to say that because I know sometimes folks listen to things out of order and then wonder, well, why was this said or why was that not said? We're talking about the facts as we know them right now on this absolutely horrific case. Some new things that we're going to talk about on today's episode. Police have a vehicle they are looking for. Not a lot of words on if it is a suspect, but more so in terms of they may have information. At least that's how it's being expressed. Police also scaling back the amount of people on the Moscow Police Department that are on the case. And we're also going to have an interview with a former assistant DA to talk about the logistics and what's going on behind the scenes in an investigation like this. I'm Tony Bruschi, Sean Reed with us as well today.
So that information, Tony, is new over the last 24 hours. There's a vehicle. This is something that hopefully can lead to something more. Body cam footage of Moscow PD that time, early morning hours of November 13th, has been released. And in some of those videos where they were issuing citations, specifically they were giving citations to some students or kids in the community under 21 for drinking, that in that body cam footage is where they see that vehicle close to the residence where the murders took place. So hopefully something will come of that.
I guess my question, when I see them asking for information on a Hyundai Elantra 2011 through 2013, and the reason that they're looking for information on that car is because it was happened to be caught in the police body cam footage, basically across the street. He was walking towards the apartment. In case you're not familiar with how this is all laid out, he was across the street. There was some citations being issued, as Sean said. But with the body cam, you know, wherever you turn and move, it is shooting. And it was shooting, meaning video shooting, towards the direction of the home where all the victims were around that time. Now, it's a college town. If you've ever been in a college town, there's a lot of vehicles out late at night. It's not necessarily slumber time in small town USA. It is small town USA, but it's a college town. So the idea that maybe there's something here with the Elantra, encouraging, but it also makes me wonder, are we really, or are they really just, you know, just trying to get anything they possibly can right now, really digging in the ether to try and find some sort of information. I wonder if there's more behind the scenes that's known about this Elantra other than just the fact that, hey, it looks like it had its lights on in the body cam footage, which took about 4 weeks for them to look at.
Well, I don't think it matters either way. I mean, we now have something that is out in the public, and anybody and everyone that has a vehicle that matches that description, there's going to be that many more flashlights, that many more eyeballs on it, and hopefully it will lead to something. So
if you are on any of the online message spaces, whether it be Reddit or Facebook or whatnot, people are digging. And I think it's good. I mean, I think sometimes the digging even goes beyond what maybe some local police officers may be thinking to look into. And they found basically every white Hyundai Elantra or vehicle sort of like it, and have found the ones that are on sale all the way from Boise to Spokane to back to where this is in Moscow, Idaho. And there's a couple that went up for sale in the last handful of days. Statistically speaking, I don't know the track record on that, and how often, when you look at vehicles up for sale, how often does a white Hyundai Elantra come up? And is there any difference now into the amount of them, or is this a spike of some sort, or an abnormality that they don't see these vehicles pop up all that often? Either way, it is something. It's more than we've had in the past. from Moscow. The detectives are interested in speaking to the occupants of that 2011 to 2013 Hyundai Elantra. Unknown license plate at this time. Tips and leads have led investigators to look for additional information about a vehicle being in the immediate area of King Street residence during the early morning hours of November 13th. Investigators believe the occupants of this vehicle may have critical information to share regarding the case. If you know or own a vehicle matching this description or know of anyone who may have been driving this vehicle on the days preceding or the day of the murders, please forward that information to the tip line. And the tip line is 208-883-7180, 208-883-7180. I don't know. I'm hoping something. I'm imagining behind the scenes they're also running through every single person who's on their radar that has been anywhere near these people that they're aware of, if anyone owns a Hyundai Elantra, I would think. And maybe they've already done that, and that's why they're coming down to the public saying, we got nothing over here. You guys got anything over there? And maybe somebody will be able to come up with something of some sort of a substance.
Obviously, it's a common vehicle, so you do feel for people that are inadvertently targeted, but you have to imagine everybody has been so sensitive, wanting to assist this investigation as much as they can. And now that they have a visual, now that they have a car, anyone they see in the parking lot, you know, not on purpose, but they're absolutely going to approach people getting into the vehicle, perhaps asking them a question or two or calling law enforcement that they saw it.
Exactly. I mean, it's the same. I mean, it needs to be done. The information needs to be out there. I'm not in any way criticizing that whatsoever. Just in the same way of all the innocent bystanders that knew these young people who lost their lives so tragically, so many people online making horrible accusations left and right just because they basically because they exist and they were within the ecosystem of these young adults at the time of their death. There's a lot of fingers being pointed right now, and it's very frustrating when you look at it online because it's almost gone. It has gone off the rails on every message board that I've seen, of every Reddit that it's just some of the craziest things that I've seen. And hopefully, you know, it will all eventually simmer down. But it just makes you hope that this is a solid piece of evidence. And it's not just a let's throw this at the wall and see if it sticks type thing that they're throwing out there right now.
I don't think that this is a fishing expedition with a Google image to vehicle and see if they can get anything to it. I believe that there's been a lot of stuff happening behind the scenes.
Sure.
And they just need that one final piece of the puzzle, that validation, that confirmation, which is why they release it to the public. And I would like to imagine that law enforcement understands the public. I mean, you have a father of a victim who is starting his own investigation to try to find the killer of his daughter and three others. So perhaps with what investigative work all agencies have done on the local, state, and federal level, that because the public and that community is so hypervigilant right now, that perhaps that vehicle that is hid somewhere in a driveway. Perhaps a neighbor saw them put a tarp on it because they knew that police were closing in. Anything that could be that piece of information to get somebody arrested.
I would think that they're looking at the ones that are listed for sale right now in the neighboring areas. This is an interesting thing you're probably going to hear about. I don't take a ton of alarm at this. It sounds bad in the way that some of the headlines are presenting it. The Daily Mail kind of made a sarcastic remark about it, with the Idaho police scaling back the probe into the quadruple homicide at the university by removing 25% of cops assigned to the case, despite not making any arrests and getting $1 million to expand the manhunt. Let's just talk about that for a second so we can understand and unpack what this means. Basically, the Moscow Police Department has kind of had almost an all hands on deck thing going on there. Very small department. So you have people who normally just work this beat or that beat or this patrol or that patrol working on this case where they normally wouldn't be. On top of that, there's 48 FBI agents there and at least 30 Idaho State police officers, plus a separate forensic unit. So what this means is six detectives with the five support staff members are now working the investigation. So it was only, when you say 25%, and a force that's not that large, that's only a few people that they're going to put back into other parts of the community. Folks that really probably can't do a whole lot more in terms of this investigation with what other than what they've already done. Now we're getting to a stage where it's going to be a lot more forensically analyzed. DNA evidence is going to come. And if you're a beat cop, that's not your thing. That's not what you're doing. That's not a whole lot that you're going to be able to help with. So I wouldn't look at this in any way as they're putting less attention on it. If anything, sometimes too many cooks in the kitchen is not a great thing when you're trying to really focus down and get solid evidence and go specific directions with an investigation.
That's a great point. And you have a force in Moscow. The Moscow Police Department is composed of 40. That's mm-hmm. from the chief of police, James Fry, all the way down to support staff, which are equally important as well. So you talk about 25% of the force, that's 10 people.
Yeah.
And Moscow PD has six detectives and five support staff, as you mentioned. So if you read just the headline, you absolutely can think, my goodness, there is nobody in custody and they're scaling back. But that is, as you mentioned, in addition to a huge Idaho State Police and FBI presence in Moscow, as well as throughout the United States that are working on this. So the headline definitely leads you in one direction, but there are a lot of eyeballs. And specifically, if you have a lead, your point, too many cooks in the kitchen, too many people assisting and making key decisions can almost be more of a hindrance than a help.
Yeah, I would agree. I wouldn't really look at this as, I think it's probably actually a positive move where you have more people who are experienced focusing this down further than just every random person that we have on staff. What can I do? How can I help? So don't be alarmed when you see that. At least my opinion is don't be alarmed when you see that. Let's talk to Lewis Goodman. He's a former Alameda County Deputy District Attorney, 35 plus years experience in the criminal justice world in both prosecution and criminal defense jobs. He joins us to discuss the logistics of the case and the DNA evidence behind the scenes. Lewis, earlier in the week, we heard some conflicting reports from the local DA's office and the police. In your experience, how closely are the two departments working together at this stage of an investigation?
Most cases that are handled by a county district attorney, in this case, I think his name is Bill Thompson, are really not cases that involve a lot of investigation. They're cases that come up in the course of the police doing their job. And they are, you know, for let me just give you some examples. For example, a DUI arrest, a domestic violence arrest, a theft offense, a drug offense. These are things that the police come across in their normal course of a day, their normal duties. They're called to some kind of a crime scene because something is going on. They get there. They talk to the people at the scene. They make an arrest, and then they write a police report. It goes to the district attorney. The district attorney reviews it and sees whether they think there's sufficient reason to charge the case and sufficient evidence to charge the case. And it's normally a very quick process. Mm-hmm. Now, in a case like this, you have a small police department. I think they have like 36 people total on the force.
Sure.
And it's an extremely complicated, difficult investigation because you have four dead bodies. You have no one at the crime scene. It's something that needs to be reconstructed from the beginning. And a small police department in a college town and a small prosecutor's office in a small county is not going to have the resources to investigate and charge a case like this. The prosecutor and the police are certainly going to work together with whatever resources they have. And in this situation, they've brought in state police investigators. They brought in the FBI. And I would, you know, find that to be exactly what they should be doing, because this is an investigation that would just overwhelm the local authorities.
They have no one to prosecute yet. They don't even know who that person or persons may be. Are they getting information as police are conducting their investigation, getting information on the direction they want to go to try and figure out who this is? Or does that come more so over to them once an arrest has actually been made?
I think the local authorities are probably working pretty closely with each other, but they also have the FBI involved, and the FBI tends to be very closed mouth with everybody. The FBI wants information to go from the police department to them, and very little information goes from the FBI to local police departments. And the FBI can certainly turn their information over to state and county authorities for prosecution, but they could also refer it to the Department of Justice and the United States Attorney's Office for possible federal prosecution if they think that's appropriate. You know, the investigation has kind of taken this scientific turn now, where they're looking at DNA that may be unidentified. You know, we know what the DNA is from the individuals who are the victims, and we know that there's DNA there from other people in the house. But if there's unidentified DNA, it's my understanding that that has already been run through the CODIS database, which stands for Combined DNA Index System, where you have thousands and thousands of offender DNAs are in that system. Mm-hmm. And I think that if some unknown DNA had been found and run through that system, it would have come up already. So now they're probably looking at genealogies in order to find what might be a distant relative of a possible suspect and then work backwards from there. You know, we've seen other investigations and some of these cold case investigations go in this direction. But this is complicated stuff, and it makes an investigation extremely difficult, and it requires enormous resources and scientific input, which is really on the cutting edge of criminal prosecution these days.
One of the concerns I think that some people may have about the DNA in this is it's a college, you know, basically it's an apartment, it's a dorm type situation where there's a lot of people that have been coming and going. There's going to be a lot of DNA there. Would there be concern for anyone who's partied in that house, been in that house, been around those people, been around anything there, that yes, their DNA will be there, and folks being hesitant to raise their hand and say, here, look at my DNA, for fear of being accused of something that they had nothing to do with?
I don't really think that's a significant problem. I really don't. Because of the things that you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. like the digital information.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty easy for people these days to say where they were and where they were not based on cell phones, based on, you know, closed circuit television cameras that pick things up, security cameras. I don't think that it's very likely that an innocent person who may have had, some contact with that house is realistically going to be considered a suspect if they're not. I do think, though, to, you know, come back to your question in terms of, you know, older investigative techniques, I mean, certainly some things are going to be there. I mean, I think that, you know, motive is not an element of a crime. But motive is sure important in terms of investigating a crime, and it's important to understand why an offense like this would have taken place. I mean, what is the motive of the individual or individuals who did this?
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me in some ways of the In Cold Blood case that was documented by Truman Capote. You know, it's possible that there may be no real connection between these individuals and the perpetrator of this ghastly offense. It's possible. I don't know. I think it would be unlikely, but I don't think anything's being ruled out at this point.
Where would they be looking for DNA of the perpetrator, of the person who went in and committed these crimes, to know that this is in fact from them? How would they be finding that sort of DNA if there weren't any clear indications that, you know, this is blood from the suspect or something of that nature? Where would they be looking to find that?
Well, you would be looking in the blood, because it's my understanding that if you use a knife of this size and in that many killings and with defensive actions taking place by the victims, and it from what I've read, you know, and the only information I have is what I've, you know, read in the newspapers or seen on television, that some of the victims did fight back. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes there will be some wounding of the assailant, either with the knife itself or by some other means. And there can be some mixing of blood. And if it turns out that they find some blood spatter or some mixing of DNA in the blood, that would be a place to look.
With all the blood that was in this scene, and I'm not trying to be grotesque or gory, but that's a lot of blood. How would they go about literally processing everything within the scene to find that little piece that may be a spatter from the perpetrator of this?
It's just a matter of very careful collection of evidence.
When we're talking about the DNA evidence and the genealogical way of looking at this, it's the way that several killers have been caught. The Golden State Killer comes to mind. How does that translate into real-world detective work?
Let's assume that the investigators gather some sort of unknown DNA, that they can't say this is the DNA of one of the victims. Mm-hmm. We can't say this is the DNA of a known person who, you know, came to this house on a regular basis. They have an unknown bit of DNA. Mm-hmm. They then look at these genealogical databases, often from things like, 23andMe.
Ancestry, sure.
Ancestry, all those kinds of things, where people have voluntarily sent in their DNA because they're curious about their own genealogy. Mm-hmm. And government investigative agencies have access to those databases. And we could get into a discussion of privacy and whether that's appropriate or it's inappropriate, but the reality is that they do.
Sure.
And they can then go in there and look at that DNA just as if you were looking for a long-lost relative and say, well, here are a few people who may be relatives of this person.
Okay.
Now, if you come up with somebody who's been living in South Carolina forever, you can pretty much be sure it's not that person. If somebody's been in Southern California and they were there on December 12th or October,
what was November.
October, November, yeah. November 12th, 11th, yes. November 12th, November 13th. You know, it's not that person, but if there's somebody who has been living in northern Idaho, in western Idaho, who's had some connection with the university, who has some prior relationship with one of the victims, well, now you have someone who may be a real suspect. And then it's a question of gathering that individual's DNA. And that can be done by, you know, following them around. They end up getting a cup of coffee at Starbucks. They drink the coffee. They throw the cup into the trash. You pick up the cup and you analyze the DNA. You bring them in for questioning. You say, hey, listen, we just want to ask a few questions. Can we do that? You know, you're not under arrest or anything. Hey, can we get you a Coke? Mm-hmm. Drink the Coke. And we give you a cigarette butt. Mm-hmm. I mean, whatever it is. I mean, there's ways to gather DNA. And then if you have that DNA match up with the unknown DNA that you've gathered in the House, well, now you have something to really go on. That doesn't necessarily make the case 100%, but it allows an investigator to focus in on a suspect.
How long does it take to go through a process like that, especially matching it up to someone that may be living in that area through some sort of genealogical DNA search?
My guess is it could take months. It may not be a quick process in terms of trying to surreptitiously gather some DNA evidence.
Once you have that sort of information that matches with someone that's in the area, and we don't know if they are the perpetrator or anything of that nature, is there a risk in just flat out going to that person saying, would you be willing to give a DNA sample versus kind of tracking them down and doing it in a more discreet manner?
From a prosecution point of view, the risk is that person realizes that they've been made and they get a lawyer and they refuse to say anything further. Because what you ideally want to do is try and bring that person in or have some discussions with that individual without them having to be Mirandized. And you only have to Mirandize somebody if they've been arrested. The police officer can have a discussion with someone who's not under arrest about anything at all mm-hmm. without reading them their rights. And what you don't want to do is get someone sufficiently scared that they're going to go get an attorney. And the attorney is going to say, whether you're in or out of custody, do not talk to the police. Mm-hmm. And that's the danger from the prosecution point of view.
Is there a risk to compromising an investigation like this if private investigators get involved? I know there's been talk. Steve Gonsalves has said that he's hiring private investigators because he's stated that he doesn't have a lot of faith in what the way the investigation is going. Having another hand essentially in the pot digging around, is that something that could help or hinder an investigation like this?
It could go either way. But, you know, if you're talking about hiring a private investigator, it's hard for me to see how that can really be a positive supplement to an investigation that's being handled by the FBI, who is undoubtedly the, you know, best investigative agency in the world.
Lewis Goodman, thanks for talking with us. Lewis, a former Alameda County Deputy District Attorney. That is going to wrap up today's episode of the program. Thank you for listening. We'll, of course, continue to keep you updated here as new information comes in on our daily roundup, wrap-up things that we've been kind of doing here, as well as the breaking news and special reports as developments continue to come in a little bit each day, hopefully inching us closer and closer to finding the horrible culprit in this horrible case. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of those updates. This is a production of True Crime Today. You can also listen to True Crime Today wherever you download podcasts. Just search True Crime Today for more on this case and many other cases. Until next time, for Sean, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening to another edition of Four Killed for What?